Trauma Therapist Podcast, episode 452. All right, guys, welcome to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. My name is Guy McPherson. My mission is to raise awareness of trauma and to support new trauma therapists just starting out on the trauma-informed journey. I do that through this podcast and my membership community, Trauma Therapist 2.0. If you're a therapist of any kind, interested in learning about trauma, and you're looking for support and inspiration, I invite you to check out Trauma Therapist 2.0 by going to traumatherapist2.com. That's Trauma Therapist, the number 2.0. .com. All right, let's get started. This episode is sponsored by cptsdfoundation.org. And one of the great things about, for me, about doing this podcast is that I get to speak to and work with amazing people. And Athena Moberg, the CEO and founder of cptsdfoundation.org, is one of those individuals. This woman is on fire. I got to meet her several months ago here in San Francisco. We had breakfast together and just had a really great talk. And I got to learn about her foundation and what they're doing. They provide complex trauma survivors and practitioners with compassionate support, skills, and trauma-informed education. Athena works together with expert practitioners and treatment centers, offering daily touch points to anyone currently in trauma therapy or who wants a safe place to come, feel heard and validated between therapy appointments. Some of the resources they offer are daily recovery support, a healing book club. They have free support groups. They also offer this really cool thing where they can send you texts just to encourage you and help you heal on your journey. So check them out at cptsdfoundation.org/traumatherapistpodcast. Once again, that's cptsdfoundation.org/traumatherapistpodcast. All right, guys, welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. Very excited to have back to finish up our series here is Sarah Payton. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
All right. So Sarah, as you may well know, is a certified trainer of nonviolent communication. She teaches people how language changes relationship in the brain. Sarah works with audiences internationally to create a compassionate understanding of the effects of relational trauma on the brain and writes about and teaches people how words change and heal us. Her special interest is the way that difficult events impact our automatic brain patterning and how to transform our tendencies towards self-criticism into self-warmth. Her first book, Your Resonant Self, Guided Meditations and Exercises to Engage Your Brain's Capacity for Healing, is out now from Norton Publishing. So Sarah and I have been putting together this series on the eight circuits here. Today is our final series, and I'll let you take it from there, Sarah.
Oh, thank you. So when I discovered Jak Panksepp's work, it excited me immensely. There was something about the idea that we have these distinct circuits that energy and information travel on that gave me a sense of my own birthright, that I and others have an undeniable and non-negotiable access to every aspect of being human. When I'm sad, it makes sense that I'm sad. I'm supposed to be sad. There's a reason I'm sad. And then once we bring trauma into the picture and we understand the way that trauma impacts these circuits of motivation and emotion, then we begin to understand so many things that we gave ourselves a hard time for before. One of the little sentences I have been playing with in the last week has been about the way people think about themselves in a negative way and they believe it's true. And so I've been playing with the sentence, it's not truth, it's trauma, to help us understand and remember that all of those ideas that we have, you know, any kind of shame or sickness, sick feeling about ourselves, all of these things are indicative that we've lived through something that we don't completely understand the impact of.
I have no idea what you're talking about when you're talking about negative self-talk. I can't relate to that at all, sir. I'm sorry about that.
I'm sure that no one in your audience can either, Guyan, but this is just me. It's only Sarah in a world of humans. So today, our special investigation is focused on the circuits of sexuality and play, which are both circuits that are a little more motivational than emotional. We spent some time with deeply emotional stuff, but these circuits take us into as well as the seeking circuit, which you'll remember, take us into this sense of the movement of humans in the world. So seeking takes us toward things, but sexuality also takes us towards all kinds of interesting things, not just partners, not just physical intimacy, but also the unfolding of authentic self. So the circuits that are maturing in our bodies as we go through puberty and enter our young adulthood and adulthood, these circuits carry us out of childhood, out of our family of origin, and they propel us into our lives. It's this growing up. The sexuality circuit is the growing up circuit. It's also the circuit of the emergence of our authentic, sort of, in a way, our sacred self. This sense of deep identity comes from us differentiating ourselves from our families of origin. And doing that integration, that beautiful integration of self with family of origin, that we're not separate from them, but we are different from, you know, we're different from them. And so sexuality is important to everybody. It doesn't matter whether you're sexually active or not. This is not about physical intimacy. This is about being who we are.
And I love what you said before about each of these circuits being our birthright. Mm-hmm. This and oftentimes trauma tends to what shut down some
absolutely
of these, and we may feel that we don't have that birthright. We might not even feel that we don't deserve that access to that. So that was very powerful. But just as a quick aside for those listeners maybe who are just jumping in on this, can you just briefly go through
absolutely. Yeah. So we're working with 8 circuits, and today we're talking about sexuality and play and a little bit about disgust. So there's 3. In the past, we've talked about the seeking circuit, which is the circuit that's fueled by dopamine. It's really almost like the whole left hemisphere, in a way, is our seeking circuit. The dopamine circuits are very expansive within the left hemisphere. It moves us into our life. So seeking, fear, I said that other things had been more emotional. Fear, rage, care. I'm missing one. Fear,
grief.
Rage, grief. That's it. Grief, panic. Yeah. So these are the primary colors. If we were thinking as artists in how our lives are based in the movement of these circuits, these are the primary colors of life. Okay. And then other things are located within these primary colors and have different shades within the colors. So shame, for example, is on the panic grief circuit, mm-hmm. and has a huge component of alarmed aloneness, which we spoke about.
Okay.
And then there are flavors on the sexuality circuit and flavors on the play circuit as well.
So what might be some flavors on the sexuality circuit?
Well, we have on the sexuality circuit, we have the physical experience of pleasure, of excitement, of attraction. All of these are kind of like attraction, especially has that like a movement in it where we start to hear the motivation, circuits of motivation and emotion. We want someone for example. That's attraction. That's the movement toward. It brings our bodies in space toward another. But there are also flavors when we go into this sense of the emergent self. There are flavors of awe that are a part of the sexuality circuit. And this then takes us toward that very yummy and occasional experience of communion in sexuality that I think much of tantric sex revolves around, that there's this sense that it's a pathway towards spirituality. It moves us into a space of deep communion.
One can imagine when someone's experienced, you know, interpersonal trauma, that could impact and affect and distort the circuit and even make someone feel that, again, you know, they don't deserve this. And again, feel how much this can, our perspective of maybe our lack of access to certain of these circuits, how that can serve to define us.
Yes. And for example, somebody who's being sexually abused, there are so many effects, and it's so helpful to know the circuit information when we're working with folks who are healing from sexual abuse and assault. Because we've talked about this before, in moments of trauma, there's a wiring together of the experience of danger or life threat and whatever else is happening. So if we have a scary sexual assault or abuse experience, then sexuality and fear can be glued together by the trauma. So then after the sexual abuse or assault experience, we move into trying to have a warm and loving sexual relationship with somebody else. And all of a sudden we find that, you know, there's nothing but fear there. We can't even access a clear and original sense of being able to touch our sexual self.
And conversely, too, you could see how someone would go seek out those other experiences that do marry sexuality and fear and anger,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. As a way to move towards healing.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the other things that's important to know about sexual abuse is that when children are sexually abused, it awakens the sexuality circuit before it's supposed to be awakened. So there's earlier movement into puberty if little ones have been sexually abused. And so there's a bit of a distortion of the access to the sense of self as a naturally emergent being. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like when somebody has experienced sexual abuse. Well, I experienced sexual abuse. And one of the effects is that we don't get to touch in a way our own self as the in innocent emergence. Instead, there's this overlay of the trauma on the emergent self. So we're not just impacting our ability to be sexually intimate. We're also having an impact on the way we see ourselves. And this impact is not, again, this is why I love this sentence, it's not truth, it's trauma. It's not true that we are, that there's, you know, a slime layer between ourselves and the world. It's not true that we are shameful beings. It's not true that we have been destroyed or irreparably injured by the experience. What's true is that it has impacted us and that we get to heal from it. We get to begin to differentiate and reclaim this circuit of sexuality, which includes physical intimacy, but also includes the emergence of a sense of a pure self. Both get to be reclaimed in the healing process.
I mean, talking about this, it just seems to me how challenging potentially it could be to move through that healing process. I mean, the amount of, I would think, self-trust, and emergence through fear, through shame and so forth, to be able to get to a point where you're able to say, okay, this is who I really am. This is my truth. And the courage.
Beautiful courage. And at the same time, to hold the power of neuroeducation. That, like, even now, there may be some listeners, Guy, who are saying, oh, I have a sexuality circuit that is not right. compromised by the trauma that I experienced. It's mine. It's my birthright. What? It gives me goosebumps, because sometimes there's, even though everything that you're naming can be part of that journey of healing, there are some of these moments that are exquisite. I think we maybe began here in our conversation about the circuit some time ago when I think I mentioned this woman who was 70 years old, 70. And she, maybe she was 60. She was either 60 or 70. And she was like, Sarah, I want to, you know, I don't want to be afraid anymore. And so we worked in this particular modality that I love that's called constellation work or systemic constellations. And we let her look outside herself. We put two people up, one person to be her sexuality circuit, one person to be her fear circuit, and let her see that they were entangled. So, you know, here's the sexuality circuit. Here's the fear circuit, all entangled. I'm putting my hands together for people who are listening to just audio and wrapping my fingers all around each other. And as we begin to touch on the idea that these are two different things and begin to do the trauma work for the little one who lived through hell, then there's a disentangling. 10 minutes into this, watching this disentangling, I said to this woman, I said, how are you doing? She said, oh, for the first time in 70 years, I am not afraid anymore. And so that we cannot underestimate the power of neuroeducation, that when people begin to understand their own brains, that something quite spectacular and sweet can unfold.
All right, guys, just quickly, I want to thank Century Motor Psychotherapy Institute for being a sponsor on this podcast. Do you struggle to help numb, disconnected clients who can't feel emotion or explore inner experience? Learn a comprehensive approach to conceptualize your client's concerns. You know, as someone who's gone through the level one and level two trainings of sensory motor psychotherapy training, I can really speak to the power of this training. For me, it was a game changer and is so inspiring. Sensory motor psychotherapy uniquely includes the body and therapy as both a source of information and a target for intervention, because words are not enough. Go beyond theories and gain practical ways to open a new dimension for effective therapy. Visit Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute online today at sensorymotor.org. That's sensorymotor.org.
Yeah, yeah. I too think here how language is important, because again, kind of going back to what you said about, you know, it being our birthright. For me, there's something about, wait a minute, that particular circuit, whatever it is my birthright. I have power for that, you know, to access that too. I'm allowed to access that too.
Yeah.
About using that particular language that really resonates with me. So anyway, that's just a little personal aside.
I love the personal asides. So let's just take a little step into disgust before we go to play. Panksepp did not include disgust in his book or in his circuits of motivation and emotion. Yet, everything that I've been discovering about disgust indicates to me that it belongs. So I've added it as an eighth circuit. He had just the seven. And so you can track the trail of disgust through the body, up through the brainstem, and up into the amygdala and the anterior cingulate. So it's got its own course, and this is why it's got its own undeviating course of movement. And so this is why I believe that it is also a circuit of emotion and motivation. And I'm doing a lot of research into disgust right now, because there's this very interesting protective quality that disgust has to protect kids from sexual abuse. It's and one of the things that happens with grooming, that, you know, that terrible pattern of perpetrators turning their attention toward young children, is that it gradually decreases the child's disgust response. Mm. So disgust is very important and interesting. And as we're working with people, if we can begin to celebrate the emergence of disgust, we can begin to create more and more power and validation for bodies. Because we really feel disgust strongly in our bodies. It's an emotion that raises the interior temperature of our torso by 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. It's an anti-contaminant emotion. It's sort of both emotion and motivation, because it wants us to get away from, it's another one that's a boundary. That's a boundary circuit. We've talked about the incredible life-serving power of rage and how there's a boundary that the life-serving power of rage brings us that's protective. And that disgust also has this. It's a life-serving circuit. And just, I don't know if this is some shared reality that you'll have, but I had shared reality when I read it in one of the articles about disgust, that like when you're little and you're thinking about sex, you go, they touch right. each other with their tongues. They put their tongues in each other's mouths. Yeah, yeah. It's so gross.
Right,
and then right. as the circuits of sexuality begin to come alive, you know, puberty, and you go, oh, French kissing. That sounds fun. You know, so you can sort of touch here that way in which disgust transforms.
Right.
And of course, if we think about fetishes and all of the things that happen with sexuality and exploration of sexuality, we can start to see where people may even be exploring this, the interplay of these circuits of sexuality and disgust. Is this making sense?
It makes a lot of sense. What's coming to my mind is, you know, oftentimes when, you know, when I was seeing clients and I sat with particularly young kids, I think, and it came the time when maybe they were sharing about what had gone on in a particular abuse situation. Mm-hmm. And I remember a few times where I think I had responded like, you know, well, you, talking about how inappropriate that was or how that wasn't right or correct or whatever. And oftentimes, you know, the child would, that wouldn't register.
Well,
what do you mean? You know, they had no sense. And it almost seems like their whole disgust circuit, like you said, had been slowly whittled down.
Right, right. It's very important for us to know this, because then when we're supporting healing, when there's a return of the disgust circuit, there's, you know, grounds for celebration in a new way.
Wow. That's interesting, because when you added this on and I was looking at this, I was like, well, okay, disgust, where does this fit? It almost, looking at it, it seemed, but as you're describing it, it's definitely part of this sphere of this facets. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So now we just have a little bit of time left to hold play, which appropriately is at the end. And it's appropriate that it's at the end because it's the most vulnerable circuit. It's the thing that goes away most quickly when there's stress in a system. So the less stress there is in little animal systems, all little mammal systems, the more likely they are to play. If they're hungry, they're less likely to play. If they're thirsty, they're less likely to play. If they're missing their mother, they're likely to be unable to play. If they're afraid, they can't play. If they're in a rage, they can't play. And if they're totally devoted to seeking, then they can't play. So I've just listed all of the circuits of attachment and motivation, except for care, and care and play have a kind of a nice combination, a nice connection. Because care, when we're in a place of care, there's a lot of safety. Mm-hmm. But also, if we're in too much, if we remember, we talked about how care and seeking could be entangled, and there could be more seeking than care, then there's just no room for play at all. So, how do we bring play into our parenting relationships? We need to decrease seeking in order for play to be able to pop up.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So play, you had asked what are some of the flavors of sexuality? Some of the flavors of play are joy and enjoyment and certain kinds of excitement and engagement. So it's both a circuit of motivation and a circuit of emotion, because it's got joy in it, but it's also got excitement in it with rough and tumble play. And interestingly enough, this is an aside, it doesn't answer your question, but Panksepp said, with all little mammals, they play till somebody gets hurt. And then it stops after that. Like, that's the natural end point for all play, yeah, including humans, which I think is soothing for mothers to know. Because I always think there's always this panic as the play starts to mount, because you're just waiting for who will get hurt. And so to know that it's a natural thing, you know, I think a natural mammalian thing makes us feel less like we're bad parents.
Right.
But to come back to this idea of the entanglement of seeking and care, we talked about how for many of us, our mothers were so busy doing that they didn't get to stop and be in the care circuit. There was more seeking, more making sure that the house was clean, making sure that the meals were cooked, making sure that the lunches were made, making sure that everybody got everywhere they were supposed to be on time. You know, a huge seeking that's a part of taking care of children. And what children need and what nourishes them is not really the seeking circuit. It brings food, sure, you know, gives us things that provide health and well-being, but it doesn't really provide that warmth that little mammals, that make little mammals' immune systems resilient for the rest of their lives. So it's hugely important to be able to move into being. And something that arises out of being is goofiness and mutual enjoyment. So there's a way that out of the care, especially for human mammals, there can be this flowering into mutual enjoyment and play. But at any rate,
I was going to say, and again, you know, thinking about people who've been traumatized and experienced interpersonal trauma, you can see how the play would be impacted, stunted, and distorted. I mean, thinking about spontaneity and creativity,
exactly, because if fear has got the upper hand, then it's preventing the movement into play. The neurotransmitter for the play circuit is adrenaline. And play loves surprise and loves novelty. Somebody's fear circuit is running the show, then surprise and novelty are dangerous, not funny. Yeah.
Right. Wow.
So play is very right hemisphere. Now let's just take a moment to talk about competitive sports, where there is a joining of play and seeking, but the seeking is much greater. It's much more important to win, especially in professional competitive sports. There may be moments of joy and mastery for players, individual players on the field, moments of beauty for fans where they go, oh my God, look at that touchdown. Look at that quarterback running and evading. Oh, it can fill your body with almost like it takes us into the sexuality circuit sometimes of like, oh my God, what beauty. It's not competitive games are not really play. And then you have first person shooter games, which I think we maybe talked about some time ago, that first person shooter games are the most compelling way to turn off the default mode network, the brain's automatic voice. So if a young man has anxiety, we know very well that it's not really permitted for young men to reveal that they have anxiety or that they're worried, or if they're worried about the fate of the planet, there's nowhere to go. There's, you can't, You're not supposed to show emotion as a man in our mm-hmm. North American world. So no wonder so many, both young men and young women, but particularly young men, move into that place where all they're doing is playing the video games. It's a very good management strategy to turn off mm-hmm. the internal voice of the brain, the lacerating internal network of self-denigration. It also is not play. It is a movement into the seeking circuit, very strongly dopamine, very strong dopamine hits. So, and then we're living in a world where we're turning off recess, mm-hmm. you know, where many schools are saying no more recess. I mean, though, this play is the most integrative quality for little beings. It allows them to integrate and practice mastery of all of the skills of adulthood and to be goofy with them and to have laughter. It's such a beautiful circuit and one that gets shortchanged in a world where both there's an emphasis on seeking and where many people are suffering from trauma. Both of these things take the play circuit out.
Sarah, first of all, I just want to remind everyone that I'm speaking with Sarah Payton. Her book, Your Resonant Self, Guided Meditations and Exercises to Engage Your Brain's Capacity for Healing, out with Norton Publishing. So if people are, I mean, this has been incredible. I mean, this series has really opened my eyes up. If someone's interested in like, oh my God, this is fascinating. I want to learn more, go deeply. What would you recommend for them?
Well, the easiest starting point is really my book, because Panksepp is a bit more intensely technical, but his book is beautiful, The Archaeology of Emotion. And there's another new one that he has out that I just got that somebody co-wrote with him that I haven't had a chance to review yet, so I don't know whether to recommend it or not. But okay. I just got it. But it's a world of exploration, the whole world of interpersonal neurobiology in the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology is an integration of much of what we've been talking about, especially for therapists. And then Panksepp himself is amazing.
Awesome. Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for this. Again, you know, as we were talking about before we started today, this has been the first time that I've done something like this, put together a series. You know, this is what, the third one?
Fourth, I think.
Fourth one in the series. Yeah. And it's just been incredible in terms of the amount of information you put forward and how inspiring it is and eye-opening it is. And I just want to take the time to really thank you for doing this.
Oh, such a pleasure, Guy. What a delight. I love the connection.
All right, so we'll be in touch.
Okay.
Take care.
You too.
This episode is sponsored by CPTSDFoundation.org. And one of the great things about, for me, about doing this podcast is that I get to speak to and work with amazing people. And Athena Moberg, the CEO and founder of CPTSDFoundation.org, is one of those individuals. This woman is on fire. I got to meet her several months ago here in San Francisco. We had breakfast together and just had a really great talk. And I got to learn about her foundation and what they're doing. They provide complex trauma survivors and practitioners with compassionate support, skills, and trauma-informed education. Athena works together with expert practitioners and treatment centers, offering daily touch points to anyone currently in trauma therapy or who wants a safe place to come, feel heard and validated between therapy appointments. Some of the resources they offer are daily recovery support, a healing book club. They have free support groups. They also offer this really cool thing where they can send you texts just to encourage you and help you heal on your journey. So check them out at cptsdfoundation.org/traumatherapistpodcast. Once again, that's cptsdfoundation.org/traumatherapistpodcast.